I'm going to read a list of things to you, and just to yourself, don't raise your hands, but you know, on your fingers, keep count of the things that you think you are entitled to have. Okay? Keep track of these things. Money, health, property, freedom, a job, a spouse, children, retirement, health care, welfare, national security. How many of you got above zero? I feel that we are not entitled to any of those things. I feel that as Americans, we have through the years determined that we are entitled to those things, but that we are truly not entitled to those things. Let me ask the question another way. If we went through the same list, how many of those things are God-given rights? I love it. Bob just like, three? kind of throws an answer out. If you look down through history of mankind, there is plenty of examples where people don't have these things. I mean, you know, there's a debate right now in our Congress about health care. And I heard a sermon recently that he said this is a moral issue and it is a God-given right to have health care. And my question to him, I didn't have a chance to address it with him, but my question was, well then, was it the God-given right for people 100 years ago to have health care? Or 200 years ago? And so the question about what is God-given or what are we entitled to is a question that's pretty pertinent for our society right now. There are a lot of people that are calling this generation of people who are growing up the entitlement generation. They feel that they are entitled to name it, and they feel they're entitled to this. And so I wanted to kind of step through some of the generations as two sociologists pointed out of the United States and in the last, say, 130 years. Starting back in 1883, we have a generation that was called the Lost Generation. They were the generation from 1883 to 1900, and they were considered the Lost Generation because they were the post-Civil War group. The country was in kind of disarray, and they were like nomads. They kind of seemed lost for a while as they were trying to find their way. The generation after that was known as the GI Generation, and that's the 1901 to 1924 group, and that was the pre-World War I leading up to World War I. And after that was the Silent Generation. This is the people who lived through the Depression. That was from 1925 to 1942. And then many of you, I think, fall into this next generation. That's the baby boomer generation. That's the 1943 to the 1960 group of people. They were the post-World War generation leading up to 1960. And then my generation actually starts in 1961, and that is called the 13th generation, which it's named that because it's the 13th generation under the American flag. But most of you have probably heard it called Gen X. Have you heard of Gen X? Okay, that's mine. And that's really what the most of things have been written about. And I'll give you six examples of what kind of defines that generation. The Gen X generation their parents had readily accessibility to birth control. They saw the legalization of abortion on demand. Increase in divorce rate was rampant through this time. The increase of mothers in the workplace, the zero population movement, and devil child films. And it took me a while to remember what devil child films were, but if you remember back in the 80s and 70s, there was movies like Firestarter, Chucky. What was the movie that Chucky was in? Child's Play. You know, some of those where little kids were the villain or the evil one, and that's what the devil child films are all about. So the generation that immediately follows that starts in 1982 and goes all the way up to the birth of Lily, my daughter. So 2003, and that's the millennial generation. They are the first group of babies whose parents put the signs in their windows, baby on board. Do you guys remember the baby on board thing? Well, many of this grew up in a time of rapid growth of technology and economy, social globalization. They are also known as Generation Y, which follows right after Generation X. And having a six-year-old and a four-year-old, I know all about the question why. That is for sure. The current generation, as defined, is what's known as the new silent generation. They are also considered artists, like the silent generation of the Depression before World War II. This generation is the first group of children born completely in the digital world. And they're known as the silent generation because they are being born into a world where we are increasingly, more and more, with communication, becoming silent. We communicate through email, we communicate through text messages, and we find it harder and harder to pick up a phone or even walk next door and talk to the person face to face. This is the silent generation. Take these generations that we live in now, and don't necessarily put birth order on them or where you were born, but as I said before, we're living in a time or a generation that is being quickly learned that is the entitlement generation. We feel we are entitled to have health care given to us. We feel we are entitled to have a job. You know, recently, I work for a company named EDS, and recently, in April, our company decided that they were going to take 5% of all of our salaries away from us, just across the board. Oh, okay, we're taking 5%. Well, in my 12-year career, that's the first time I've ever had a negative increase, if you will, in salary. And then, about 4 weeks ago, it was decided that they were going to take some more money away from us. So, you know, I've had about 9% taken away from my salary over the course of the year, which when you calculate that in terms of considering you normally get a 3 to 5% raise, you know, I lost about 12% in salary this year. And this happened globally in EDS. Most people this happened to. And there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger about it. The first cut I looked at as, well, they took 5%, so 5% is 1/20th. And so I saved 1/20th of someone's job by giving up 5% of my salary. And I felt pretty proud about that. The second one, you know, I wasn't so proud about it. It hurt a little bit more. But there's a lot of anger because of the entitlement of salary. Because I feel, all of us feel, that we are paid a certain amount of money and we should expect to be paid that amount or more the next day or the next day or the next year. And our plans for retirement, our plans for the future are based always on inflation and based always on the increase of salary, especially in corporate America. Another entitlement that we feel, and I'm not going to labor on this a whole lot, but I do want to touch on it, is the fact that we can, on a whim, decide when to terminate life. Abortion is a huge issue in our country, despite the fact that many of us want to brush it under the covers. I heard a lot of people in the last campaign say, well, how can you vote on one person based on abortion alone? And I agree with that. You can't do that. And I'm not trying to talk poorly towards our President Obama in any way, shape, or form, but I do want to quote one thing that he said, not to point out his attitude toward things, but to point out our society's attitude toward abortion. In his campaign, he said, I've got two daughters, 9 years old and 6 years old. I'm going to teach them first of all about values and morals. But if they make a mistake, I don't want them punished with a baby. And that was in defense on why he supports abortion. But, you know, I can't blame President Obama for those comments. Like President Clinton before, in the scandals he had in office, President Clinton really isn't to blame for that. The society he came out of is all he was representative of. The lust-driven society that he was a leader of is a representation of what we have become. And the put me first, I am entitled generation is a representation of what Obama has come out of as our leader and the president of this country. And to put the blame on him for those kind of comments, sure, he owns blame in it, but we have to put the blame on all of ourselves. Whether we're for abortion or not, which I hope all of us are not, we have taken on an attitude of entitlement, and abortion is just another piece of that entitlement attitude. If you have your Bibles handy, would you please turn to Jeremiah chapter 19? I want to read to you something similar that was happening in Jeremiah's time. And in verse 3 in chapter 19, it says, "Hear the word of the Lord, O kings of Judah and people of Jerusalem. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Listen, I am going to bring a disaster on this place that will make the ears of everyone who hears it tingle." In verse 4, "For they have forsaken me and made this place of foreign gods. They have burned sacrifices in it to gods that neither they nor their fathers nor the kings of Judah ever knew. And they have filled this place with the blood of the innocent." Who's the blood of the innocent? We find out in verse 5. "They have built the high places to Baal to burn their sons in the fire as offerings to Baal, something I did not command or mention, nor did it ever enter my mind." This time in Israel's history is immediately before they go into captivity. This is one of the severe things that God had against Israel, of them sacrificing their sons in fire to Baal. Do you know what happens to an aborted fetus after it's aborted? It's incinerated. We do not superficially worship Baal in this country. But in our entitled state, we have put ourselves up to be worshipped above God. Our interests, our desires, our wants, our needs to not be punished with a baby has led us to the sacrifice of 50 million babies since Roe v. Wade, and the number climbs. The warning from God through Jeremiah was to the kings of Judah, if you read that in verse 3. "Hear the word of the Lord, O kings of Judah." And then he says, "the people of Jerusalem." He's not just saying the people who we are, but he is including them. But he's talking about the leaders. He's talking about the leaders of that country. But and remember, in Israel, we didn't have a separation of church and state. So the leaders of Israel were just as much a spiritual leader as our pastors and our ministers are now. And the leaders of this country were allowing this to happen. And it sounds pretty much like they were promoting it. Our leaders today, we have leaders making some of the very same mistakes. And we have leaders not only making the mistakes, but teaching us that when we make the mistake, not to live with it. When we make a mistake of premarital sex and a child is born, we decide we're going to get rid of it, push it under the covers. My wife, Corey, and I were talking a little bit about this on the way over here today. And, you know, the interesting thing about abortion, and it's becoming more and more wide known, but the heart really, it is harder on a mother in the long run to abort the baby than it is to have the baby emotionally. Most women go through a great deal of depression, which is completely understandable when you realize what they're doing. But God has set up a world to let us make mistakes. He's given us this world to live in. And he doesn't every step of the way say, "No, come on, you need to go this way," or slap your hand every single time. He gives us freedom. He gives us the choice to walk our paths and to make these mistakes. Why? Why does he do that? Does he do that so when we make the mistake, he can sweep it right away? No. We make these mistakes because we learn from each and every one of them. Every one of these mistakes we learn from. And when we learn from them, we get stronger. And when I learn from my mistakes, my strength helps you. And your mistakes, makes you strong, and that helps me. When we wipe them away, when we push them away and we say, "Well, let's just get rid of it. We don't need that mistake. We can live without it. We can go on with life without remembering that mistake. Let's wipe its existence away." We don't learn the lesson. We lose that lesson. And so now, you know, how many years has it been since Roe v. Wade? 30, 35 years? Something. We had an anniversary recently of it. Now where are we? We're in a society of rampant premarital living conditions, of rampant divorce, rampant single-parent families. And these are mistakes that we can live with. But we have to be able to be a people that can step up and admit the mistake, not sweep it under the covers and deny it. We are not entitled to sweep those things under the covers. We are entitled to come before God in prayer and ask for forgiveness, but not to ignore them. Let me give you a practical example of how this works. How many of you took a science class in high school? Everybody? Okay. In your science class, your professor or your teacher gave you a textbook. And you guys read the textbook probably quite a bit in class. You took it home. You had reading assignments, those sorts of things. Is that all you did in science? What else did you do in science? Labs. Why'd you do labs? Because reading about science doesn't make any sense. Reading that hydrogen mixed with oxygen creates
water.
Okay. How in the world does that work? Well, so we do experiments in our labs in science class to understand how things work. And that's kind of how God is. God has allowed us to have our own lab. He's allowed us to be here to experience things. To put this chemical with this chemical and see if it blows up in our face. Or to see if it makes something great and wonderful. And from that we learn. But we're becoming a society that just doesn't want to learn. Our nation, over the last 30 years, has had an extreme growth in wealth, prosperity, and as I've said before, entitlement. One fact I've found shows this clearer than anything is the baby boomers generation and before were all people who during the summer, when they weren't in school, majority-wise had jobs. I would be willing to bet that most of you had some kind of job between the age of 16 and 19 when you weren't in school. In 2007, the USA Today reported that 49% of American teens between the age of 16 and 19 were working that summer, which means 51% of teens that year in that age group had no job. Now, did they need a job for money? No. So mom and dad were probably, you know, supporting them, buying them what they needed. 2007 was a pretty good year financially. We were, you know, coming out of the post 9/11 tragedy, you know, starting to build up. It was right before this recession started hitting. We're doing pretty well. And teens, not being convinced by parents to go out and get a job so they can make their own money to buy their own movie tickets or their own hamburgers or whatever, again had a dose of, I'm entitled. When you're 16, you're quite capable of making money. Generations before us, when you were 16, oftentimes you were married and running your own house. And now we've got 19-year-olds. We even have people going through college who have never had a job. When I was a supervisor at EDS, I would look at resumes from time to time of people just straight out of college, and their work experience was empty. But it's because it's not their fault. We're teaching them that. Our expectations of them or that you are entitled to whatever it is you want. Take it. Don't work for it. Take it. And part of this attitude is Paul wrote about beautifully, and I'd like you to turn over to Romans chapter 12. It's not only a shift in finance, but it's a shift in the way we think about ourselves. And in verse 1 he says, "Therefore I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will." And in verse 3, "For by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment, in accordance with the measure of faith God has given you." When you travel around the world outside of this country, people are excited to meet you because you're an American. Because America, the United States of America, has led the world in a lot of things. We have really pushed the envelope in a lot of directions. And we have done, in my opinion, a lot of good. But the American way is not always as exciting to everybody as we think it should be. For us, it's beautiful. And it works. And we love it. We love that we can get in our car and drive from New York to California and have freedom of passing through borders and not have to worry about those sorts of, you know, the persecution of going into another state or another country. We can have open travel. We can have freedom of religion. We can have all of these wonderful things that our forefathers have set up for us. But we often think higher of ourselves than we should. We often think that our way of life is the only way of life. And, you know, from my perspective, I see that, and I understand that. You know, I can't imagine why somebody wouldn't want to live the way we live. But when you look from the outside in, and you see the attitude of ownership that we have on the world, you start to see why people wouldn't want to live like an American. When people have certain morals and they see the American society going against them of greed, gluttony, lust, personal self ahead of all things, it becomes quite clear why the American way is not for everybody. And I think Paul was talking about that. You know, he don't put yourself higher than you are. That's an elevation of self. That's self-worship. And that's what entitlement is. Entitlement is putting self higher than you really are. I know I'm taking you from one end of the Bible to the next, but if you wouldn't mind going back to the book of Deuteronomy, and in chapter 9. After the Lord your God has driven... Oh, I'm sorry, in verse 4. After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No, it is not on account of the... No, it is on the account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It is not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going to take possession of their land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations. The Lord your God will drive them out before you to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand then that it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stiff-necked people. I love Scripture. You know, here's something that was written 3,000 plus years ago to a people vastly unrelated to us in time and location and geography and technology and understanding. And the words can be stated to us today. We are Americans. And in America, we have been given a ton of liberty. God has blessed us bountifully in this country. But don't confuse yourselves to thinking it's because you're righteous. In God's church, no matter what church it is you're talking about, if you know Jesus Christ and you know that Christ is your Savior and He came and died for you and lives again to save you, it's not because you're righteous. We are not entitled to believe that we are righteous. We are entitled to believe that Christ alone is righteous. But yet, it permeates all of us. It's in our DNA. It's hard to not think these things. It's hard to not look at the news and look at other countries and the way they've chosen to live their lives or set up their cultures and go, man, they are really naive. They really don't know what they're doing. It's hard. I mean, it's ingrained in us as citizens of this country. But entitlement also has another danger involved in it. And now if you go back to the New Testament, in the book of Luke, and in chapter 14, I want to share with you the words of Jesus here. And in verse 1, one Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. And then skip on down to verse 7. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both you will come and say to you, "Give this man your seat." Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, "Friend, move up to a better place." Then you will be honored in the presence of all your fellow guests. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Can you imagine the embarrassment of that moment? I mean, I think probably all of us have done something similar to that in the past. But, how deflating would that be? You know, you walk in all high and mighty, "I was invited by the host, and I'm going to go sit right up next to him in the best seat." And then he walks in and goes, "Oh, hi, Brent. I got about, 20, 30 people that need to be sitting up here in front of you. Why don't you just kind of walk around back behind the curtain so you don't embarrass yourself too much and go over here to this other seat?" Oh, how deflating would that be? Well, I have a group of guys that I meet with every Wednesday, and we have lunch. We all work together at EDS, and we formed this little group 4.5 years ago. And there are very few occasions that I miss this lunch. Sometimes it's because I need a good butt kicking, and that these guys are good for it. And sometimes I need someone to build me up, and sometimes I've got something I just want to share. But we truly are brothers, and we truly are iron sharpening an iron in these meetings that we have on a weekly basis. This past week, one of the men, his name is Wayne, shared with me. He recently has done some studying into addictions, and one of the addiction behaviors is based around expectations. And a quote that he quoted me is, "Expectations are just premeditated resentments." Now, I argued with him because I thought it was a little too cynical to paint a vast picture that any expectation is a premeditated resentment. But think for a minute, and he gave me this example. He said, here's an example of it happening in my life. I am the person in my marriage that comes home and makes sure dinner is ready, and I make sure that the dishes are all cleaned up. That's just kind of one of the jobs I do around the house. I love to cook, these sorts of things. I have an expectation that I'm going to have dinner ready every day around 6 o'clock, and that my wife is going to be home so that dinner can be hot when she walks in. Well, my wife is not very good at timing, and she often is late. This is not my wife. This is Wayne's wife. I'm quoting Wayne. Yeah, please don't look at Corey, because that is totally the opposite of my wife. Love you, honey. Yeah, I almost got in a lot of trouble. I don't think there's a shovel big enough to dig me out of this one. But Wayne's wife has trouble with timing. But for years, Wayne set the expectation that tonight my wife will be on time. And his expectation every night was premeditated resentment. Because he knew that his wife was going to disappoint him time after time after time. So, take this back to entitlement for a minute. When we feel we're entitled to something, we are expecting that we're going to get it. And when we don't get it, it causes anger. Anger burns up from us when we don't get our expectations. You're driving down the road, and you're expecting that your lane in front of you is going to stay free of a car right in front of you. And then a car cuts you off. What happens? You get mad. I've taught Lily so much how mad I get. Backseat off and yelling at cars when I'm not. Because she's a really good... It's quite embarrassing. But that you get angry when you set an expectation and it isn't met. And that's what he's trying to say. When you set an expectation, you're setting yourself up for anger. You're setting yourself up to be disappointed and angry at the result. I found this story the other day on the internet that I want to read and share with you. You guys are going to love this image, especially those of you who this applies to. One afternoon, a man came home from work to find total mayhem in his house. His three children were outside, still in their pajamas, playing in the mud, with empty food boxes and wrappers strewn all around the front yard. The door of his wife's car was open, as was the front door to the house. Proceeding into the entry, he found an even bigger mess. A lamp had been knocked over, and the throw rug was wadded up against one wall. In the front room, the TV was loudly blaring a cartoon channel, and the family room was strewn with toys and various items of clothes. In the kitchen, dishes filled the sink. Breakfast food was spilled on the floor. Dog food was spilled on the floor. A broken glass lay under the table, and a small pile of sand was spread by the back door. He quickly headed up the stairs, stepping over toys and more piles of clothes, looking for his wife. By this point, he was really worried that she may be ill or that something more serious had happened. He found her lounging in the bedroom, still curled in the bed in her pajamas, reading a novel. She looked up at him and smiled and asked, "How was your day, honey?" He looked at her in bewilderment and asked, "What happened here today?" She again smiled and answered, "You know, every day when you come home from work and ask me what in the world I did today?" "Yes," was his reply. She answered, "Well, today I didn't do it." We often take for granted those things that others do for us, and it sometimes takes them stopping for us to appreciate what they do. The same thing is also true of blessings we enjoy. How often do we think about such wonderful blessings as electricity or running water? We seem to appreciate them a lot more after a power outage or a break in the water main. Ironically, the things which we should most be thankful for, because they are continually there, are the things we are most likely to take for granted. Here's a sobering thought. What if God said one day, "You know all those things I usually do for you? Today, I didn't do them." Entitlement sets us up for this. When you feel you are entitled to something, you are set up for that. The husband in the story felt like he was entitled to come home and his wife had had everything cleaned. It was an expectation. And quite frankly, it sounded like the wife always did it. We live in a country that has given us more than any other country has ever given its people. Better things, a better way of life, a wealthier way of life, a sense of pride, and because of that, a sense of entitlement. We are not entitled to have a good retirement. We are not entitled to have money. We are not entitled to have a job. We are not entitled to sit down and have things pour in on us bountifully while we do nothing. We are entitled to go out and seek these things and work for these things and hope for these things and try for these things. We have that right to pursue them. We do not have the right to have them given to us. In conclusion today, in Proverbs chapter 3, the wise Solomon writes in verse 1, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but keep my commands in your heart, for they will prolong your life many years and bring you prosperity. Let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Then you will win favor and a good name in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil. This will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. I told you what you're not entitled to. What you are entitled to, what are God-given rights, when you pursue God, when you pursue Him and you seek Him and you discern His Spirit, I'll bet you can say them with me. The fruits of the Spirit are, come on, love, joy, peace, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control.